FM, revenez-nous la semaine prochaine pour une autre émission d'En profondeur, où vous entendrez ensuite... entre autres, l'homme préhistorique est aussi une femme, l'entrevue des oreilles loin du front avec la chercheuse Marilyn Patoumatis.
We need to press pause again. That's why, once more, we need to stay home and avoid all non-essential travel. Gatherings are prohibited in red zones and are to be avoided in orange zones. And it's important to keep following the everyday health measures. Let's press pause again to curb the spread. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves properly. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome to the Peep Show podcast.
News and stories from the sex industry.
With Jesse and PJ Sage. Welcome back to another episode of the Peep Show podcast. This week we talked to Melissa Gier Grant about Nicholas Kristof's op-ed in the New York Times that led to Visa MasterCard pulling out of Pornhub. We discussed trafficking narratives, anti-porn feminism, the business model of Pornhub, sex worker issues with payment processors, and more. We're here today with Melissa Gier Grant, who is a staff writer at The New Republic and the author of Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work. So welcome, Melissa. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me back, you guys. I feel like the world has changed a lot.
You know, I saw this, well, we've all seen this story. Everybody's been talking about, this story with the Nicholas Kristof op-ed and then sort of the following policy changes with regards to Pornhub, and we were like, oh man, we got to get Melissa on because I can't think of anybody better to really give us the background and the context to this really complicated story that I think has like so many angles that we need mm-hmm. to kind of try to tackle in order to fully make sense of what's going on here.
Who is Nicholas Kristof, and why did he write this op-ed? And
according to your letter, I hope it's okay for me to say this, but I understand that you were once asked to write an entire book on Nicholas Kristof.
Yes. I think it was going to be a short book. And actually, I ended up writing Playing the Whore instead.
That's probably
which I think
a good
was
choice.
The better call. Yeah. the idea was to do sort of a series of books about public intellectuals, you know, like debunking them or sort of putting them in their place. And I just said to myself, like, the amount of reading I would have to do to write this book, I can't imagine anybody would then want to read that book. On the other side, like, I was researching, you know, Nick Kristof's archive of columns at the New York Times on their website, and there was something like 1,400 columns, and only six of them were about porn, or maybe nine of them were about porn. Three were about Pornhub, and six were about Trump. So I'm imagining that they had something to do with Stormy Daniels.
Yeah,
right. This is not a topic he writes about a lot. You know, your listeners might be aware of his previous writings about Backpage and Craigslist. And there's a lot of echoes, you know, in what's going on with Pornhub right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, namely trying to get credit card companies like Visa and MasterCard to stop doing business with them as a result of what he published in his expose. And I put expose in quotes, not to say like that stuff that he found on Pornhub, the images of abuse and non-consensual material, that wasn't there. I'm sure that it was there. I don't dispute that
right.
at all.
Right.
But it's not news to anybody who has ever had anything to do with the porn industry. I think that there's lots of complaints that have been brewing for a long time about Pornhub.
Right.
And it's Nick Kristof just sort of Columbused his way into this and now is getting all this credit for making these changes to the site, which are, you know, actually are going to have pretty dire consequences.
Right, right.
Right. And seem to have, you know, not been done, you know, or conceived in consultation with a lot of the stakeholders, people who are involved in the porn industry and who, you know, make and sell porn for a living, right? Like there are a couple people, I think Stoya and
Siri
actually,
yeah,
were both kind of very, very briefly mentioned in the piece, but there wasn't really much consideration or discussion at all about how these kinds of payment processing changes, in case the listeners...
Oh, except he loved to like lay out in tons of detail the like atrocities.
Yeah, that's a real hallmark of his. It's like, I really hate rape and sexual assault, and now I'm going to like graphically detail to you, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, rather than like talking to, I mean, I think this is the thing that was like really frustrating, I think, for a lot of performers, is that, like you said, anyone who's worked in the sex industry and particularly who's worked in porn knows, like, Pornhub has been a problem, and people within the sex work community have spent a lot of time saying, hey, how about you don't let people put up porn if it's not like from the people who are in the clip? Why don't we verify our ages? Why don't you like, you know, and then he gets on and says, you know, almost the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you make this point actually in Playing the Whore. It's been a little while since I've read it, so bear with me. But I, you know, if I recall correctly, I think one of the points you made in the book, because you do end up actually talking about Christoph a fair amount in the book, and you know, all these issues with his coverage of you know ostensibly of sex trafficking and of things like Backpage. This way of framing the issue itself is kind of a form of pornographic voyeuristic content, this way in which he like really talks in explicit detail about these things in order to kind of provoke sympathy, but at the same time it's really like you know, at times maybe unnecessarily graphic.
Yeah, it's graphic, and it's also like, for what purpose or to whose gain, mm-hmm. right? Like, if I remember correctly, the subtitle of his book, Half the Sky, is From Oppression to Opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I think that that cuts both ways, right? In his mind, you know, the work of women's rights, which he sees himself as like a nice guy ally to, who very generously lends his column to the work of women's rights, as if no one else is doing that work. You know, he believes that, you know, the way out of violence, the way out of oppression is, you know, weirdly just sort of like economic opportunity, like all these like very neoliberal kind of ideas of like what rights and freedom mean, you know, the right to participate in the marketplace. And in a way, the porn industry is, it being the most legal visible part of the sex industry, is particularly as strip clubs are getting run out of cities and pushed further to the margins, you know, this, and people spend so much time online, right? So like thinking of visibility here also meaning like the time that we spend online. I don't know, like this is an opportunity, right? This is a market opportunity for people, but no, not that business.
Right.
No, don't do that. And then it's also his own opportunity. I mean, this is somebody who, you know, every time something like this happens, and this is by far not the first time, there's a whole group of people with different sort of stakes in dealing with the aftermath of Nick Christoph. Not people who want to, but people who, when he raises his head up like he did in this issue to speak on porn, then it's, it creates this like ripple effect where like we end up having this like completely boring conversation that has not you guys, not us, but you know what I'm saying, like the terms of the cultural debate shrink. Mm-hmm. And you know, he has done this, I don't know, if a lot in his coverage of Africa, and if you go to the blog Africa is a Country, I think he's his own tag, and you can just dig through that and see like all of the times that he's you know, just sort of played the white savior role. And the white savior role, you know, is raced, but it's also gendered, and the way that he plays it around the sex industry and then hides behind this, oh, no, I'm not against all porn.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the reality is the people that, in my mind, fed him these horrific stories and whose campaign he is advancing and who are very happy that he has supported them, those people are 100% anti-porn. And that's the thing. That's the thing that's getting lost.
Yeah, let's definitely talk about that. I mean, that's one of the really kind of key threads of this story, is that there is this group, which he does make reference to within the piece, this group called Trafficking Hub, or this campaign called Trafficking Hub, which is kind of project that falls under this broader umbrella of this group called Exodus Cry, who are kind of a Christian-oriented group who are, you know, very much outspokenly against, you know, not just porn that involves the exploitation of children, but all porn in general, and also has ties to a lot of, you know, other problematic political agendas like the anti-abortion access movement, for example, right? So at least this is my understanding. So
yeah, that's correct.
I just want to set that all up, but maybe you can help us tease out all those connections a little bit for people who haven't, you know, had the chance to put all those pieces together yet.
Yeah, I feel like I sort of had a roadmap going into this conflict, that Backpage and the peril conflict over Backpage sort of showed us how these things go.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have... not to go all the way back in time, but like, let's go back to the 1980s at least. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a time when the Christian right is coming to prominence and influence. This is also a time that the women's movement, or at least parts of the women's movement anyway, are really invested in porn as an issue. Those two groups end up coming together in that work, and it's actually kind of a huge failure. The culture moves on. By the time we get to the 90s, I think there's this sense that, like, really, porn is a huge issue. Have you heard of AIDS? You know what I'm saying?
It just didn't
capture the same sort of cultural cachet that it had before. It was not cool. Not maybe it was ever cool, but like, it just, I feel like the anti-porn movement went underground. And Elizabeth Bernstein, the sociologist, talks about this in her work, that it sort of comes back up at the turn of the century in the guise of the anti-trafficking movement. There had been people doing really solid work around violence and exploitation in industries like sweatshops. Like, remember, like, the whole, like, anti-sweatshop movement? Mm-hmm. And they were talking about things like labor rights. They were criticizing sort of global capital. And that movement sort of gets twisted in this other direction of, like, no, like, what we're going to call this particular set of labor abuses, when people are forced to do work they don't want to do, or tricked or otherwise coerced, that's not a labor abuse or labor exploitation issue. We're going to call that trafficking now. Mm-hmm. And then sex trafficking kind of becomes this separate beast, because the people who believe in this sort of way of looking at labor abuses don't believe that sex work could be work. And so that's why you get this division of, like, labor trafficking and sex trafficking. Yeah. And it was like a perfect vessel for the anti-porn people to sort of, you know, re-coalesce. You see the same anti-porn women's groups coming together with the same religious right groups. So, like, one of the groups now that's really at the fore of this anti-porn hub thing, though they're not getting quoted nearly as much as Exodus Cry, is a group called the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. That sounds sort of like a legit thing, right? It kind mm-hmm. of sounds like the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. However, they are just a rebrand of a group that's been around since the 60s called Morality in the Media. And what they're mostly known for is, like, trying to get Cosmo out of, like, school libraries and stuff like that.
Cosmo. You know,
like, their understanding of sort of, like, what we should be talking about when we talk about sex is, like, so further back than even talking about porn.
Yeah.
So, anyway, these are the people that right now I think looked at first Backpage, and before Craigslist, but let's just talk about Backpage, which sort of became like a famous name, right? In a way that, like, a lot of other escort ads sites were never going to be like household names, right?
Right.
It's really mm-hmm. funny to me, like, the main site for my entire career, and I think it continues to be really significant, is Eros.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And there has never been this big anti-Eros campaign. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that Backpage sort of took off is because the ads were free.
Right.
Yeah.
And Eros is really expensive in big cities.
Eros has just gotten more and more and more expensive. Like, I remember in the late 90s, not that I was working then, but this was like the old Dom legend, that you could get a 3-photo ad on Eros doing BDSM for $50 a month. And that's just, like, not real anymore at all. So yeah, like, and that site has been around literally since the late 90s. So anyway, this group sort of, I think, latches on to things that have recognizable brands
yeah.
that, like, a lot of people are going to get mad about. And then they don't sort of put, they don't couch their opposition to it in the terms of, you know, sexual morality or sexual purity or abstinence or anything like that. They frame it as like, we are living in a sexualized culture. We are living in a pornified culture. And it almost sounds progressive.
Right.
It almost sounds feminist even, right? The anti-porn people of the 80s, I don't even bother trying to sound feminist. It's just weird now how it sort of morphed into this, because as far as I can tell, National Center on Sexual Exploitation and also Exodus Cry do absolutely nothing when it comes to actually doing work around sex trafficking. All they seem to do is these like awareness raising campaigns, making websites, getting people to talk about them, getting their names and stories, and then working with legislators. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that National Center on Sexual Exploitation was behind with some other groups is getting state legislatures to adopt these resolutions that porn is a public health issue. Mm-hmm. And to like trying to shift the frame like even further, like these are people who are really invested in the concept of porn addiction or sex addiction.
Right.
And they're trying to really make this seem like a very neutral evidence-based sort of argument, which it's not. And it doesn't take that much scratching of the surface to see that what's going on behind this is the same old religious right use of sexuality as a way to build power. And that is like the thing I want to underline. This mm-hmm. isn't about going after sexuality because we're a bunch of prudes. They may be.
Yeah.
Who cares? Honestly, if that's all that it was, like, who cares?
Yeah.
But they are trying to build political power.
Right.
If you listen to the Exodus Cry people talking about where they want this anti-Pornhub thing to go next, they want congressional hearings. They want new legislation. So essentially, they're looking for like a new SESTA FOSTA.
Wow.
Which, like, mm-hmm. sidebar for the legal minds, as I understand it, if Pornhub was at all involved in, you know, displaying anything that had anything to do with sex trafficking, you could even make an argument that like it would be way closer to being complicit in sex trafficking than Backpage, where it's just ads and nothing is actually happening
right.
mm-hmm, on Backpage, right? I think that you probably could, and this is not to give anyone any ideas, but you probably could bring a prosecution using SESTA FOSTA right now.
Right.
But that doesn't matter, right? Because no, the whole narrative is we need a new law. This is, we can't do this with what we have. These people are getting away with the exploiting children.
Yeah.
And it's the same stuff they said about Backpage.
Right.
And sure enough, like before SESTA FOSTA went into effect, Backpage got taken down anyway, not even using SESTA FOSTA. So
right.
this, I don't think this even is about a particular slate of laws that they want. They want to build power and influence.
Yeah, you're right. I think that is scarier because, you know, them just not liking porn doesn't really matter that much. But them trying to build political power is a much bigger deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's something that Nicholas Kristof is never going to engage with because
yeah.
it's, you know, well, over his head.
Well, I mean, that's so there's so many angles here that are interesting to me. I mean, interesting in the scary sense,
yeah.
not in the like
not detached, in the detached sense,
you know, academic sense, but I think, you know, are really worth picking apart because they're important. So one of those, I just kind of want to step back and kind of reiterate that, you know, it seems like there's a real parallel here that is happening in the way that this porn addiction or public health rhetoric is being taken up as a way of trying to attack the porn industry. It seems like that very much parallels the way that in the 80s onwards, these same groups were adopting feminist language. Like, you know, maybe the most enduring legacy of 70s feminism, at least theoretically, you know, in theoretical terms, is like the concept of objectification, right? Has now become a mainstream term, a mainstream concept. You know, and that's one of the things for example, that we've seen interestingly, you know, has been picked up by more right-wing opponents of pornography.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think, yeah, it's just interesting to me this pattern of sort of taking whatever kind of rhetoric is carries weight at a particular moment in time, and then trying to sort of rebrand your message in those terms, whether they're feminist terms, whether they're sort of scientific or scientistic, language,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
In order to make it more palpable to a broader population, more people than, just the Christian evangelicals that would be, find the language of sin or whatever, compelling.
Yeah.
And so I just think that rhetorical move for mm-hmm. starters seems like a really important thing to kind of highlight.
Yeah, there's also this way that it's like, how do I even put this? These groups at their core, groups like Exodus Cry and also the Dominionist ministry behind their leadership, which is called the International House of Prayer. Yes, IHOP.
Yeah. Wow.
They were sued by IHOP for trademark infringement. And
were they really?
And I use the acronym IHOP KC. And I didn't get into this in my story for the New Republic, but there are numerous stories out there of people who have escaped this organization and describe it as a cult, describe it as abusive. And so there's a lot of questions raised about that particular group. Mm-hmm. But when Exodus Cry started, their executive director was in leadership at IHOP KC. And Lila Micklewaite, who's now in charge of the Trafficking Hub campaign, started working at Exodus Cry at the same time that she was what they call an intercessory missionary at IHOP KC, which is a position of leadership as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of connections between these groups, which they're really trying to reject. Like if you go on Exodus Cry's website right now, they'll be like, we're not anti-LGBT. Like we aren't racist. Like we aren't religious. We're nonpartisan. And it's like, sure. And then go two clicks into IHOP KC's language. And they're like, not just anti-LGBT and anti-abortion, but just like anti-bodily autonomy.
Yeah.
And in their view, like bodily autonomy is like, it doesn't exist. There's women's bodies. The reason I think that they are able to sort of attract their own more conservative, perhaps membership, as well as sort of more progressive people to these messages is because they'll talk about sort of the sanctity of women's bodies being violated by the porn industry. And to your point, PJ, about rhetoric, that kind of goes, you could hear that in two different registers.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a register where it's men enclose and cover women again, let's return to coverture, let's take their sexuality into our bodies and say we're in control of it. And then you could also read it in a yes, porn has really spoiled sex. And a lot of the pushback I've gotten to my critiques of Christoph and Pornhub is essentially at the end of the day they're doing good, so it's okay. And even if that were true, it's not okay.
Right.
Because the way that they're doing it is at the expense of so many people.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's further empowering a group that I think could be very dangerous, particularly given the far right turn that our country has taken.
Yeah.
And specifically the ways that sex trafficking and pedophilia as moral panics have been a huge part of that, whether you're talking about QAnon or the Hunter Biden stuff or Hillary Clinton, going back to Pizzagate, this is a very scary, toxic brew.
Yeah.
And I think there's never been a point in time in my life that I've been watching this and in the 15 years that I've been covering it that I have seen sort of the furthest right groups in the anti-trafficking world getting the most influence, drawing out the most people, turning out the most supporters, doing massive amounts of fundraising, millions and millions of dollars. This is a political bloc that's forming, and they're just using Pornhub as the banner that's hanging out front.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so much collateral damage there, right? When they do that. And I think that's that's where, our listenership comes in, because so much of what we cover is the porn industry. And I think that what people in our community are experiencing right now is not being able to monetize their, Model Hub accounts, and mm-hmm. suddenly having payment processors as large as Visa, MasterCard, who are saying, no, we're not doing business anymore on the place in which they're making their living. because of these groups.
And that's been totally erased from, you know, the sort of Pornhub, like the trafficking hub people, and from Christoph. Like, I think that that's really important to point out, that like they, I think, are only successful in this because porn is still stigmatized, right? And porn performers are stigmatized. And so like they're not even seen as a constituency,
right,
that you have to have at the table.
The irony there, getting back to this idea of like, you know, Christoph's sort of neoliberal approach, or like giving people, you know, sort of, we need to rescue, you know, these women who are caught up in the sex industry by like, you know, giving them opportunities. I mean, the truth is that a lot of people have come to the sex industry precisely because it offers opportunities. It offers a certain kind of flexibility.
Yeah, and autonomy.
And autonomy and yeah, money, yeah. That is hard to get in other sectors of the economy. And, you know, and we know well that a lot of people have, you know, started making porn, or, you know, done mm-hmm. other forms of sex work to get out of abusive situations, or to, you know, rebound from a divorce, or to, you know, any number of things, to work when they're disabled, to, mm-hmm. you know, a whole range of reasons that people, you know, have sought out this, you know, this kind of work. And to sort of just ignore all of that, you know, and I guess I should also say, you know, Ian, because in many cases it pays better than other alternatives in an economy where, you know, women are systematically, you know, underpaid mm-hmm. relative to their male counterparts, or their cis male counterparts. But I guess I you know, just preface with all of that, but I think that, you know, the irony is that in this, like, you know, attempt to in this case, you know, rescue the children, mm-hmm. You know, what's actually happening is that like a lot of people are losing their livelihoods. And
yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to jump in and say, is that I think, you know, you had brought up earlier that there is a lot about Backpage that's analogous here. And I think when we look at this, we could say, okay, so one of the things that we know about the closure of Backpage is that it drove things underground and made it much less safe for sex workers, you know? And I think that, you know, I've talked to, you know, a number of models and performers who've said, hey, I would like to just sell my porn and process it through the means that I can, that are all like above board. But if that gets taken away from me, now I'm going to be forced into more underground markets, which are not going to be very safe for me, you know? And I think that that's what we're not talking about.
Yeah. And I don't want to at all take away from that, like, in sort of like front loading everything that I did about, you know, sort of who these groups are, what these conflicts of interests are. Like, you know, I think the thing that, the reason that people don't want to maybe get as far into that is because they want to pretend that like, we're just talking about the children here. And so politics don't matter, and history doesn't matter.
Right.
And all, you know, influence doesn't matter. We're just all going to throw everything out the window because the children.
Yeah.
And that's very powerful and mm-hmm. very effective. And that's only possible because porn performers are still so stigmatized. Like,
yeah.
I feel like the thing that this, and maybe to a larger degree, OnlyFans has sort of opened up more public conversation about anyway, is because of the gig economy, you know, because of the sort of race to the bottom way that the gig economy has played out, like not giving people more flexibility and autonomy, but actually putting them in positions where their labor is being devalued,
right?
Where they have losing control at work, even though they're being told they're independent contractors who, you know, can do whatever they want.
Right.
So, you know, whether that's like Uber or DoorDash or whatever, now you have people working in that economy who are also gigging, doing porn.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or this, like, the story, I'm not gonna to mention the names in this because I don't want to further contribute to this, but there was a story this week in a tabloid in New York outing an EMT who had an OnlyFans.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
And you know, she was very clear, like, this is because we don't pay EMTs what they should be paid.
Right.
Right. And that gets like totally lost in the story.
Right. It
and
ends up looking like a scandal when she's just like, well, yeah, but I need to pay my rent. Right. So
in a pandemic, we can't get our shit together to pay EMTs. No, right. We can't. So And then there's all the people who like have built successful businesses on these websites mm-hmm. and, you know, maybe have diversified their income because they've seen over time how like every website changes its rules abruptly. And then you could like lose all of your money and your customer base if you're too dependent on any one site. And the thing that I would love to talk about a little bit, because I'm still wrapping my head around this, is, but Pornhub is really different because it's not just like a tube site. Like it occupies all of this space and operates along with MindGeek as sort of a monopolizing force in the industry mm-hmm. that if they stop doing, if Visa and MasterCard stop doing business with them, then the collateral consequences of that for OnlyFans, for other sites, like it's just, I really am worried about that.
Right. The precedent it sets and.
Right. I mean, that's what I was thinking about too.
We've already seen little ripple effects mm-hmm. like, Clips for Sale, who partners with MindGeek but isn't owned by MindGeek, changed a bunch of terms of service, you know, in recent days because of, you know, fear, you know, with regards to, you know, the payment processors maybe coming for them mm-hmm, next. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a lot of concern that, you know, that if this can happen to Pornhub, it can happen, you know, to anyone.
Because I mean, Visa MasterCard has way more to lose by pulling out a business with Pornhub than with, you know, Minivids.
Yeah. Right.
And if they're willing to do that, then why would they not just pull out of Minivids and out of I Want Clips and everything else?
Right.
And there's also like, I don't know, it feels like you can't really not do business with Pornhub. Like if you're producing content and your stuff's going to end up on the site pirated.
Right.
You know, then you're sort of forced into signing up for a verified account so that you can actually perhaps profit off of your own work.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's what, you know, a lot of our friends really much felt like that. Like, you know, and I think that's been like kind of a weird outcome of a lot of this, is that people within the community feel like they're suddenly forced in this into this position where they're defending tube sites that they actually hate.
Yes. I mean, it's the same with Backpage. I remember Katie Simon said at the time, I don't know if she said this on Tits and Sass, I think we were talking and I may have quoted this in a story, that like no one, like we shouldn't be backed into the corner of having to defend Backpage. Like Backpage only exists because selling sex is criminalized.
Right.
And if it were not, the advertising of this would be such like a boring nothing thing, and it also would be above ground and you could acknowledge what was actually going on the site.
Right. And I mean, that's the same thing that happened with Pornhub, like, that people were like, oh, my stuff is already there, so I might as well like claim it as mine, because then at least I can get a couple pennies every time somebody watches
it. let's just be really direct about this. Like, we, you know, we are content creators. We have historically avoided putting our stuff on Pornhub because we hate Pornhub. Because Pornhub as a company, you know, it's historically, its business model has been driving out other companies who actually paid models mm-hmm. out of business mm-hmm. By turning a blind eye to pirated content and, you know, driving down, you know, both the cost of, you know, porn and subsequently the wages that porn performers are paid as a result. And, you know, it's, most people in the industry look at it and think it's, you know, one of the major causes of, you know, mm-hmm. the economic hardships that have befallen, you know, especially mainstream performers, but, you know, in general, everybody who works at the industry. And, mm-hmm. You know, while many models have sort of said, hey, like, you know, we can't beat it, so we're just going to have to work within the system, some of us have, you know, just refused because we...
Yeah, but it's not as if, like, every 2 months I don't think, man, you know what, I think, like, my principal, like, position is stupid and I should give it up and try to make more money.
Exactly. And my point is, either way, whether you're on it because, you know, you hate it, but you feel like you need to do it in order to maximize, you know, your business, mm-hmm. or you hate it and you're avoiding it, we all hate it. Like, there's, you know, it's not as though you're going to find many people in the industry who actually have a lot of love for Pornhub.
Yeah.
But the problem with this, and I think that I think frustrates a lot of folks in the industry, is that the critiques that are being levied against Pornhub and like the way that Pornhub is being attacked is is not for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not with any sort of like labor consciousness, right? Like it doesn't understand the complex relationship that this like monopoly within the adult industry has, and in, you know, mm-hmm. and the negative effects that's had for workers, because it's just more or less written off all of us workers in the industry as worthless, as not valuable, as not even worth, you know, more than a sentence or two of print in a however many 2,000 word article or whatever, right?
Right. The thing that I have so many thoughts, like I'm going to try to organize them, you know. A lot of the other kinds of pushback I've been getting to my story and the commentary that I've been doing is like, well, who cares? You know, like porn is bad anyway. And like, who cares if those people lose their jobs? And it's like, are you talking about the people who run and profit off of Pornhub, mm-hmm. which actually is profiting off of performers' labor? Or are you talking about the performers themselves? Like,
right.
sort of like everything across the gig economy that's built on this lie of, you know, being an independent worker who's calling the shots and then making the platform sort of invisible,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that you can't point to the platform and be like, oh my God, they're my boss.
Right.
Pornhub is my boss. And I never signed up for that. And I never wanted that.
Yeah.
And it just feels like a shakedown. It feels like somebody coming to your house and just being like, oh, it'd be a shame if no one saw your porn.
Right.
Or you could give me like, you know, 75% or whatever cut that they're taking. I don't actually know. But there's something that was coercive and built on non-consent
mm-hmm.
in the business model of Pornhub, as I understand it.
Yeah.
And so of course that's going to create a situation where people, you know, are desperately begging them to take content off the site because it's, you know, a recording of their rape.
Right. Right.
And Pornhub is like, maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
And that to me, it's like, if you didn't take sex workers' consent seriously, and if you didn't value them, even though your entire business would be worthless
right.
without them,
mm-hmm.
then of course you don't give a shit about other women.
Right.
Not that only sex workers are women, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like there's this, and I think that's getting lost too. It's like the solutions that would have been good to give performers more power and control over
right.
their work would also, I think, make it easier for people to get content taken down that shouldn't have been on the site in the first place.
Yeah, there's like solutions to this. Other sites have figured this out, like to only allow performers to upload their own content, to verify them, to have them turn into 257s that have their, you know, signatures and age verifications. I mean, there's a lot of ways in which like Pornhub could have solved this problem.
Why didn't they get a massive 2257 sort of crackdown? I mean, I don't know that there have been many industries or any studios that did, and maybe it's because they're not regarded as a producer.
Yeah.
And they can just think, well,
that's right. I think it has a lot to do with the kind of 230, you know, mm-hmm. model of it being, you know, being an analog to YouTube, right? Like it's
right.
So it's, you know, framed as user generated content. It's not a US based company, it's a Luxembourg based company that's actually based in Canada.
Right.
And you know, so I think, you know, that has allowed it to dodge some of those laws. But I don't actually know. You know, I think that's hard to you know, it's hard to to fully make sense of, because
yeah.
it does seem that they don't abide by the same practices that most of the other sites that we work for do.
I remember when 2257 was first happening. This is maybe like 15 years ago. And there was a lot of fear that the record keeping requirements for it, because at the time, I don't think it's changed. Is it required you to have, you know, on file every performer's legal name,
right.
identification to back that up, and to make those files available at a particular physical location that could be, you know, that basically like the government could show up and request to inspect it at any time.
Right.
And, you know, yeah, if you're Evil Angel or whatever, you can do that. But if you're just like people making porn as independent creators,
yeah.
you're going to put your address on the internet? Are you kidding?
Right.
And so I think that, like, this is all sort of like the end of a story that started a long time ago in the lifespan of the internet anyway, that, like, you know, porn performers have been, the individual performers and creators have been squeezed out. And that also helped empower things like Pornhub. So, like, maybe you can't anymore start your own pay site because it's impossible to get Visa and MasterCard to do business with you. And if you sign up for one of the other, like, intermediary companies, like, they take such an outrageous cut. Right. At a certain point, it doesn't make any sense. And so then that sort of forces you into the arms of Pornhub.
Right.
You know, for all these people's, like, complaints about, like, pimps and traffickers, it's like, do you actually know what that means, though?
Right.
Like, or do you only care when it's sort of this, like, you know, perfect victim? Like, can you not see that sex workers and porn performers were also exploited by the system?
Right. Or this racialized other, right? Like, the flip side, yes, of it is the, you know, the image of the pimp, right? And so if it's like a white person in a business suit, you know, who works for, you know, a payment processing company, who works on Wall Street, then they can't be a pimp, right? Because they're one of us. So
they're Canadian. I mean, my God.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah. And so I think part of it too is the failure to, you know, to understand. And I think we sort of know this, is that it's when we can racialize exploitation, when we can other exploitation, you know, in a certain way, then we can problematize it. But, like, in a capitalist economy where, like, exploitation is part of the very fabric of society, when, you know, when it's, you know, kind of exploitation, yeah, that is part of the fabric of our life, then it's hard
and
for us to
call it out. Specifically, part of the institutions that are trying to call this out,
exactly,
right? Like,
yeah,
let's be clear, like, the New York Times, where Christoph published this anti-Pornhub piece over the summer, published a piece by a member of Congress calling for the army to come in to face down racial justice protesters,
yeah,
which led to a huge uprising at the New York Times and a reckoning around, you know, anti-Black racism and their leadership. And so to me, it's just sort of like, if the New York Times is going to become a platform by which they're going to oppose racism and racial exploitation and porn, and Christoph always likes to talk about sort of his presumed nationalities who he's watching on screen, which how he knows for sure, I don't know. But, you know, he'll be like, oh, yes, and this Indonesian woman, and this, it's like, really? Okay. sure. But, like, he always mentions it if they're not white. And it's this, I don't know, it's like, look inside your own institution. Like, the New York Times opinion desk is still majority white. It's white majority white leadership. Publish racist work. And then just today, there's this glowing profile of Jeffrey Toobin, who lost his job at The New Yorker because he was masturbating on a Zoom call with his coworkers.
Yeah, I just saw that came out. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I saw it.
It's basically like, wow, what an interesting guy. You know, here is his entire professional trajectory. He was taken down by this thing that maybe wasn't a big deal. And, like, you know, quotes like Malcolm Gladwell being like, maybe it was all a misunderstanding. And they frame him, you know, essentially forcing his coworkers into watching him masturbate,
right,
as like a debate,
right,
that we're all having.
Yeah.
It's like, are you okay? That's really interesting. So what does this say about whose consent,
right,
matters to you?
Right.
And it's not like the people who observe that are like powerless people. Like, you're talking about, like, Masha Gessen was on that call, right? Another New Yorker contributor. Jane Mayer was on that call. Like, but it doesn't matter, right? Because, like, it's a white guy,
exactly,
who's just like,
I mean, could you imagine, you know, if he was black? Like,
oh my God,
you know, how this conversation would have changed. I mean, it's just absurd to even think about. Like,
mm-hmm, even more absurd, like, the reaction to it was like, oh, well, you know, if you guys are a prison abolitionists and, like, you can't take this carceral solution to Jeffrey Toobin, or, like, we'll think about Jeffrey Toobin's labor rights. It's like, no, I'm sorry. Like, your union doesn't have to stand up for you when you've, you know, non-consensually masturbated in front of your coworkers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even sure that in the context of The New Yorker, there would ever be a situation where masturbation would be consensual at a meeting.
Yeah.
Like, I'm finding it very hard to imagine. Maybe. Yeah. It's just like, okay, so at the end of the day, what this is about is preserving white male power. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if the consequence of going after Pornhub, to take it back to that, is, you know, reducing the incomes of people who were already marginalized, who are already lower to middle income, who were already, you know, blocked from other forms of work,
right,
because they're trans, because they're undocumented, because of whatever, because of disability. Mm-hmm. Those people take the hit, then like, it's not an unintended consequence.
Right.
It's just part of how this thing goes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess to bring it back a little bit too, I think one of the points that we kind of elided, but, you know, I think is important to, you know, to really tease out, is that, you know, there's a way in which, you know, the sex workers who are right now being bearing the brunt of these policy changes with regards to payment processing, who are losing their livelihoods, because they can no longer get payments from this site, are natural allies to victims of sexual abuse and exploitation, however that occurs via Pornhub. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's really the case that I don't think, you know, any of us want to be working on a site where stuff that was posted non-consensually, it, you know, is available, both because, you know, we
lose
morals
control of our,
and,
yeah,
you
and,
know,
and we also lose control of our own content when
also,
we allow
right,
that.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. But, you know, even for more mercenary reasons, like, you know, the same kinds of lack of control, the non-consent, is also bad for our business. Mm-hmm. You know, and mm-hmm. and you would think that, you know, that we would be the first people, you know, the most natural allies, a campaign to try to scrub non-consensual pornography or you know, child abuse from the web would turn to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, ultimately, and I think this is to your earlier point, you know, we're not seeing that because it seems like, you know, the underlying agenda here for a lot of these groups ultimately isn't just to eliminate a problematic and abusive forms of pornography, but really to eliminate pornography altogether, or to criminalize, you know, sex work altogether. And I think that's the rub here, is that, or the thing I find most frustrating is that it is, you know, is in our total erasure from this story as content producers, is that we really actually would be natural allies in these efforts if only we were like allowed a seat at the table.
And there's so many reasons for that have sort of been thrown in my face over the last few days. You know, one is that for a lot of people, I think particularly cis men, if the people that were arguing with me are any indication, though probably cis men are more likely to argue on the internet about shit they know nothing about. But there's, you know, there's this like kind of idea that like the performers and Pornhub are the same.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to bring up is that, you know, Visa, MasterCard pulling out of Pornhub, I think feels like such a, has so many sex workers, freaked out, because it comes in after a long list of other being shut out of other payment processors. So having Payoneer shut down a couple of years ago, right after FOSTA-SESTA, having, you know, being locked out of GiftRocket and out of Venmo and out of PayPal and out of, you know, Cash App. And, you know, sex workers have a rightful or a justified like paranoia of not being able to process payments like on their own, and not even related to sex work, related to anything, you know, like so many of, you know, we lost money when Payoneer shut down, but I think that many of our friends have had their bank accounts shut down and their all of their money seized, and the same has
happened.
We know
people who no one at their home address is allowed to have a PayPal account.
Yeah, like, you know.
No one who lives at the entire address.
Yeah, or has the same last name. A friend of mine, yeah. I was talking to her the other day, and her husband and her brother, because they... you know, have their bank accounts connected in a certain way. Also, our lifetime and IP
banned.
Yeah, from you know, from using PayPal. And so, you know, it's becoming, I shouldn't say it's becoming, it's been, but like harder and harder and harder for sex workers to make money, like, and for not even doing things by selling content or by selling hardware or whatever, you know, and by hardware, I mean, you know, panties, socks, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this is just like one more blow in this, like, how is it that we're going to be able to make a living, which, you know, isn't to be alarmist. You know, I don't want to be alarmist, but I do want to point out that, like, this is not the only time that something like this has happened.
And it's always so vague, right? Like, I mean,
yeah.
People like banks and financial products can suspend your access to them, even if what you were doing wasn't a violation of the law, but right. Simply if they think it's like too high risk of a transaction for them yeah. to take. And like, mm-hmm. it then ends up sort of casting this sort of like haze of criminalization over yeah. everything. And mm-hmm. this is like super speculative, but like, I would be really interested to read sort of an analysis of how these financial regulations end up criminalizing larger swaths of the sex industry than we typically yeah. think of as criminalized. I mean, they're not criminalized in the sense that, like, theoretically, yes, you aren't breaking the law. So that maybe it's penalization. Like, there's criminalization, yeah. which mm-hmm. is one circle. And then there's this larger sort of community who are penalized. And it's almost like, this is one of the questions I remember from the Hacking Hustling conference mm-hmm. a couple of years ago, the last time that we talked.
Yeah.
And somebody was saying, like, Facebook knows you're a sex worker, even if you don't tell it you're a sex worker,
totally.
Because
oh,
of
yeah.
the third party data sharing, because of the way that it can sort of aggregate different interactions that you've had and interests and pages you visit and other activities on other websites. And that to me is like, you know, there's a whole conversation that's not happening around the way that people are excluded from these financial yeah. services. Mm-hmm. And then that creates power for Pornhub, because then they're like the only place where you can go to accept yeah. payments.
Right.
So that's a problem. That's a huge mm-hmm. problem. I mean, the other conversation that's not happening, and I know people have tried to build these bridges between sex worker community and the community of people who are working around, like, quote unquote, revenge porn or non-consensual material. And, you know, a lot of the people in that community who are doing that work are lawyers or legal scholars, and they have sort of hit upon 230 as like their boogeyman.
Yeah,
and,
totally.
And they kind of sound like Ted Cruz, to be honest, when they're just like, everything bad on the internet is the fault of 230. Right. So now we're getting this like sort of bizarre, like, feminist conservative coalition of people who hate 230, but right. for really different reasons. And I think that, you know, I don't think that 230 is the obstacle to keeping that material off the web. If right. anything, 230 provides safe harbor for people to make those moderation choices and not mm-hmm. lose whatever protections they have still as publishers. And that's sort of like why something like FOSTA SESTA was so destructive, not just because it changed 230, which is important, and, you know, groups like EFF got involved because they don't want to see this chipping away of 230.
Mm-hmm.
But it also kind of got us to that, like, circle of penalization. So now, you know, Facebook isn't going to allow you, or Instagram isn't going to allow you to post anything that might mm-hmm. seem like, you know, any kind of sexual solicitation, even if money isn't involved. Like,
right.
there's so many things that you can't put on social media sites
yeah.
that have nothing to do with breaking the law. It's
right.
just their vague way of defining what kind of content we're going to penalize.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then these are the people who are actually being penalized, right? Not Ted Cruz.
Right. Yeah, right.
Right. I think it's really these points, though, about, like, this way in which, like, you're not necessarily criminalized. Like, you don't have a felon status, right? But that you still have this mark that's associated with you. That,
yeah.
You know, whether it's Facebook sort of triangulating your identity and determining you to be, a sex worker, or, you know, it's being banned from these payment processors or whatever, but this idea that even though like you've not technically done anything criminal, but you still have this mark upon you that excludes you from like really, really crucial aspects of society, I think is like, I don't know. I think it's something we don't talk about enough. I think like if, you know, non-sex workers, if civilians have, you know, experience anything like that, it's maybe a credit score and the way that credit scores sometimes get used in like job applications. But like what we're going through is like that times 10, you know, it's, it's the, the level of banning, you know, it's not just being denied, you know, access to like certain financial things and maybe certain jobs, but even like access to having a social life, you know?
It builds in this sort of second guessing behavior. Like I was saying to you guys when we weren't recording, like I still will never leave money in my PayPal account. You know, it only took so many stories of hearing people having everything in their account seized for, you know, alleged terms of service violations.
I empty my accounts out if there's like 20 bucks in it. I just don't like, I don't trust any of the platforms at all.
No, and they haven't, you know, got our trust. And I don't even know, like at this point, I think there was a point in my life, you know, maybe 10, maybe 5 years ago still, where I was like, these platforms like need us. And so, you know, at the end of the day, like they're not going to drive us away. And I, I don't think that that's the truth. If it ever was the truth, I think that they're doing whatever they want because they effectively have monopolies. There is nowhere to drive us to. There is no alternative to Facebook, really. There is no alternative to Instagram.
And if there is, they'll just buy it.
And like, I don't know if I want like, you know, Elizabeth Warren to come in and like break up MindGeek per se. I don't even know if she can because of jurisdictional issues. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't think that these problems are unique to what Pornhub is able to do. Like you were saying, PJ, that like some of the revenge porn people were, you know, noting that like, it's other social media platforms that are hosting all of the same problematic content, you know, non-consensual videos, videos of rape. And there is no similar outcry around Facebook or Twitter, or when there is, it's like not a, you know, front page of the opinion section of the New York Times resulting in financial institutions breaking up with Facebook 36 hours later.
And there's, and that's, you know, the big difference in that, I guess, comes down to stigma, but also maybe it's the sort of too big to fail kind of nature of, you know, Facebook or, you know, just being so big that, that they actually have pull in a way that, I don't know. I would have honestly thought maybe Pornhub did too, but, you know, but it, but I think like we were saying earlier, if, you know, if these payment processors can walk away from Pornhub, then they can pretty much walk away from anything in the adult industry. So
The thing that's so upsetting about it, and I don't want to like lose sight of this before we have to go, is this idea that like, well, of course sex workers should just accept the fallout because you're already worthless. So what's some more worthlessness? And it is so,
or you should have expected it, you know, you should have known better.
It's so crushing. And like, you know, I use us in this context because I'm pretty sure there are parts of the internet that still think I'm a sex worker, and whether or not I am anymore. And and it is just that it's just, there's only so many ways I can say sex workers' lives have value. And you should believe sex workers, including saying that to some of the same people who are just like, you know, hashtag believe women. And it, I just like, I think that's part of the reason I pivoted so much to talking about the political implications of this and the sort of aspects of it that are about building power and influence off the backs of us. That to me is where I want to take the fight, because I, part of it is a reaction to that. Just like, I can't, I just don't have it in me anymore to be like, listen to sex workers, listen to sex workers. I've said it, I've said it, I've said it. And if you're not going to listen, then like, I'm not going to like, you know, use the space that I have and have fought for to like say the same thing over and over again. And I don't know, like, it, I feel like the sex work community has never been more visible. Never had more access to, you know, members of Congress who support decriminalization, let's be honest, and yet like we see this.
we probably should wrap up. Is there anything we haven't covered that you want to just, you know, gesture towards before we close?
I mean, I hate leaving on a bummer note, so, but I think, you know, if there is sort of something to take away from this, like, we do see how Sesta Fosta and the fight against Backpage really energized communities mm-hmm. of sex workers who hadn't normally been involved in the movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by that I mean like independent, you know, middle to higher income escorts, essentially. And so all of a sudden, like, they were, maybe for the first time, feeling the consequences of this kind of penalization. And I wonder if there might not be something parallel, even though these communities overlap, right? Like, the number of porn performers who are only making porn and not doing any other kind of sex work or any other kind of work, period. I don't know how many people are in that boat.
No.
C is for
cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for
kitten.
Cam.
C, wait. Fianrof. C. U, unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one.
T. T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
Pour limiter la propagation du virus, le Québec doit se remettre sur pause. C'est pourquoi, à nouveau, nous devons rester à la maison et éviter les déplacements non essentiels. Les rassemblements sont interdits en zone rouge, à éviter en zone orange, et il faut continuer de respecter les mesures sanitaires de base. Pour freiner le virus, remettons-nous sur pause. Informez-vous sur québec.ca/coronavirus. On continue de bien se protéger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Chers auditeurs et auditrices de CKUT 90.3 FM, veuillez prendre en note que nos bureaux et nos studios de diffusion et d'enregistrement sont présentement fermés. Toute notre programmation est constituée de reportages préenregistrés, des archives récents, ainsi que d'autres programmations spéciales. Notre campagne de financement annuelle est également rapportée. Nous avons pris ces mesures par souci pour la sécurité et la santé de nos employés, de nos bénévoles, de nos membres, ainsi que de leur communauté. On vous remercie de votre compréhension et restez à l'écoute. Toujours avec vous, CKUT 90.3 FM.